saying how much they want a strong woman. What they really want is a cheerleader.
I'd like someone who's physically very frail and won't stop talking.
I just want what everybody wants. I just seem to have a harder time getting it.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Maximum Film. It's episode 320, and some lawyers can be dirty. It's your host, Ify Wadi Way, and in the booth with me are my friends. So let me introduce you to them. First up, we have the Christmas Zaddy himself, a wonderful critic, all-around great fella, Alonzo Duralde. What's good?
Oh, thanks, Ify. What's good is the new American terminal at DFW Airport, because this is a thing I've never seen in an airport before. Above each gate, like facing you as you are walking down the long-ass hallway, there is a light-up sign that tells you the city that the plane is going to and how many minutes away from boarding it is. And it's, like, super visible and really convenient. And it's the kind of thing you see it, you go, why haven't we always done this? Why have we had to go look behind the person at the desk at the little screen or the little... I remember when they were still, like... letters they would slide into the thing. Giant signs with actual pertinent information. And it's like, why did no one think of this until now? Anyway, it's great.
I feel like you meant to start that last sentence with, in my day, we had giant letters that they stuck behind. I'll also shout out Denver Airport. Denver Airport has that, like, as you're it's enormous and a nightmare, but as you're walking along, it tells you the city on the, like, hallway part words. Anyway, I feel you. I like the specificity of that, Alonzo.
It gave me a good feeling about traveling.
Ooh, well, you know, speaking of good feelings about traveling, this person gives me a good feeling about traveling to Minnesota. It's none other than Super Festival programmer, Queen of the Midwest herself, Treya Clark. What's good?
You say that someday we're going to do a tour and I'm going to throw you guys all into an RV and we're do Minnesconsin and it is going to be joyous.
Don't threaten me with a good time.
I honestly,
get me on that pontoon.
I daydream on this. I love it so much. Before I get to my what's good, I want to thank the woman who reached out to me on Instagram, because last week what was good for me was Nail Teak, which was this nail thing that I've been using, and it really has given me, like, the world's toughest nails. But she says it has formaldehyde on it, and I like that she specified. I'm not bringing that up for, like, crazy, I don't like chemical reasons, but it actually would dry your nails out. So thank you for that, if anybody is listening to me for beauty tips, which I'm assuming is why people tune in. I will be switching to a formaldehyde-free polish as soon as it gets here this week.
When you know better, you do better.
What's good with me is related to a buddy of all of ours, Ms. Ooh. Maria Lewis. Ooh. I finally read The Graveyard Shift. She had a new book. Maria, for anyone who doesn't know, please go Google her 18 times. She has been a guest here several times. Last joined us for Barbie. She's an incredible writer and bon vivant. And she's published several novels, and her most recent one, The Graveyard Shift, came out last month, and I stormed through it, and it is, if you are like, oh, I would really like to read something that gives me everything that a movie like Scream does, it is horror, it is punchy dialogue, it is pop culture references, it's nothing but, like, Australian Kiwi slang that I was like, I don't know what half of this is, but I'm going to use it incorrectly. I'm so proud of her. I had such a good time. And it's about a woman who has the graveyard shift at a small radio show in Melbourne. And someone calls on Halloween and says, there's someone in the room. And she thinks it's a hoax, but da, da, da. It is a fan listening who is stabbed to death. And then she starts solving the murder. I loved it. I'm very proud of her, but I loved it. You know what? I'll tie it into Ify. I know you love a nice, clean segue. It would be a great read while you're traveling. How's that?
Ooh.
Oh, how's that? Yeah.
Eh? Yes,
well,
indeed.
Congrats, Maria. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yes.
Big, big congrats. That's amazing.
Ify, what's amazing with you?
Yeah. What's good with me is, you know, I did a quick turnaround trip this weekend to NYC, and I, you know, did some sets, you know, and it was that was very good. Thanks to everyone who has come out and seen me at my shows. Definitely continue to do so I can keep doing it. It's you know, I need you, and hopefully you need me to laugh. But beyond that, yeah, it was good. Hung out with a bunch of friends, and now I'm back in good old LA just in time to see the Lakers preseason game against the Bucks. We lost, but that we're not talking about that. We're talking about sitting in those seats, cheering on my guys, and hoping they pull out a win. So
you are not wrong. Alonzo and I have actively not been talking about that.
Yeah. I know how badly you've wanted to.
Yeah.
You've been dying to cover the Lakers here on the pod.
To be fair, the Bucks, a Midwestern sports team. So
yeah, yeah.
It should have been on my beat, but it was not.
Yeah, Milwaukee.
Yep.
That's, hold them down. Horns up or something. All right, we're cross-examining this year's Palme d'Or winner, Anatomy of a Fall. Then we'll give our nominees in a courtroom-themed Hall of Excellence. But first, it's time for Itadick, our movie news segment where we go through the week's movie news and answer the question if it's important and do we care. So, Drea, you're up first.
All right. Over 2,000 producers have signed a petition asking to drop the final P from AMPTP. That second P stands for producers, but as we have said here before, the word producers defines a large group of folks in the film industry who largely have nothing to do with the AMPTP and whose interests it certainly does not represent. The petition is part of a larger goal to more clearly define the meaning of the term producer in a Hollywood context. And of course, who would want to be associated with the group that is proving to be the industry's biggest and dumbest bully? Fun fact, I am one of the 2,000 producers on that petition, so feel free to scan for my name and just really soak it in. Is this important? Do you care?
Oh, well, very important. I just want to mention it's Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, and I didn't realize until this moment that I have never had any idea what AMPTP stood for during this entire strike.
Oh, yeah. Man.
I think we gave a whole lot of different words for those. But it should be, people have said like that instead of saying producers, it should be streamers. There's been something from the beginning, like, A, it implies that, if I can just get on my producer soapbox for a moment, it implies that the average producer is the one with the heavy lifting and the money and the has clout. All of the power, and that is not the case. We are almost always work for hire. This organization started when the studio system was structured in a completely different way than it is now. And being a producer, it's the only job on set where you do not have, well, that's not the only. Join me with the PAs over in the corner, but we do not have health insurance. We do not have we're generally flat rate. Like, if you're producing something, you're the first person often asked to like give up your pay to just keep it going. I've been developing things for years and never been paid for that part of it. And again, I'm the smallest of the names of those 2,000 signatories. So it's brutal. And then to have it then lumped in at any point, because it's also, nobody knows what a producer does, because every producer's role on every job shifts a little bit. There's a different number of producers. And then there's managers and things who get that as a title, and they're not actually doing the producing. So anyway, I signed it because I do believe, especially as the AMPTP seems so adamant to set themselves up as complete professional asshats, take my name out of your mouth. Take my job title out of your mouth. Like, I don't like it.
I do love the "we're not with them" going on.
Oh, yeah,
here.
Definitely.
She like, doesn't that's even that's go here. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, because it is true, because, everyone, within the industry knows what's going on. But it is like a situation where, like, everyone outside of it, Drea's back home, enjoying a cheese wheel or something. And she mentioned she's a producer, and they're like, "What? The queen is associated with the AMPTP? Don't you know? Get her out of office." And we don't want to risk that happening.
A bloody coup.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the great thing about my sovereign reign is it's completely reluctant, which makes it even harder to get rid of me. It's a strange dichotomy, but it's true.
You and the people who would overthrow you are sort of out passive-aggressiving each other.
Exactly.
No, I mean, I don't even want it, really. It's okay.
That's the Midwestern way. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's the thing. That is the thing. All right, well, you know, you'll be happy to know that the Eras movie has been released into the world to much fanfare. Taylor Swift's concert film has been a pretty big deal since it was announced, and now we know that it raked in around $93 million domestically and $123 million internationally. This makes it the second highest October debut in the U.S. following 2019's Joker, which opened to $96 million. It's also the best ever opening for a concert film by a much wider margin, beating out Justin Bieber's Never Say Never, which opened to $73 million in 2011, which is nuts if you account for inflation and all that. But we're not accounting for inflation. We're asking, is this important? Do you care?
Am I the only person here who saw the Eras tour over the weekend?
Ooh, probably. Alonzo! Probably, yeah. You are, I'm sad to say.
Oh, baby, I was there opening night. I was on Friday, rather.
Packed your pockets full of friendship bracelets? Stood in line?
You know, it painted the 13 on my hand and everything. Woo! No, I don't. Yeah. I don't listen to 21st century music is my embarrassing revelation here. I don't know anything. I'm too busy listening to old, you know, Antonio Carlos Jobim records. But no, I had to go review it. And I have to say, like, it's a dynamic film. Like, it is, we were counting the camera operators in the closing credits because there's many angles. There's so many places that they are in the SoFi, you know, stadium getting all of this. And it's edited together in a really zippy way. It's 2 hours and 48 minutes, which as somebody who is not a fan of this performer, started to feel a little long for me. But I get the appeal. I get why people get excited about it. It was cool that, like, every album had its own sort of, like, you know, stage look and outfit, and even the mics changed for each one of them. I think it's all been very craftily put together. The whole, like, the higher ticket price, the only screening on the weekends. They're making it an event akin to what the tour was, and the tour apparently is also this, like, record-breaking juggernaut. And, I think they figured out a way to make this special for the fans. I think a lot of other music docs just sort of feel like a thing that's been thrown out into the world with not a lot of care to it. And, you know, Beyonce, who attended the premiere, is taking a lot of notes because hers is coming December 1st.
Oh, yeah.
I love it. I also do love that she was, I mean, this is really off of our sort of movie news realm, but I do love that Beyonce was at this because there is such a concerted effort in all of culture to try and have those two women be competitive towards each other. Like, they were touring at similar times. Mm-hmm. And then I also appreciate Taylor, even if I don't care if it's feigned, her knowing that she should be, I know my place next to Beyonce, and it is a little to her left and bowing down. So, like, I appreciate all that. Taylor Swift, I am a fan of, like, I have a couple of her albums, and I don't listen to a lot of modern music, like the oldest woman in the world. But I worked for the American Music Awards for years, as you guys probably remember, and she always performed at those and was just such a pro, like, and not everyone was. But I have a soft spot for her. I think she's a very shrewd performer and businesswoman. And if something's going to be making this kind of money, then, yeah, at least nothing I feel icky about, because that happens constantly. It will be very interesting from our actual normal track of what we cover to see how this influences what funding goes into a movie. I mean, we're just going to see a glut of concert films from here on out, and there's gonna just a race to the bottom, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
Of how good they are.
Yeah, there's no way they're gonna, like, hit the zeitgeist the way this one did. Although one thing I did notice in the closing credits of this movie at the very end was the SAG-AFTRA logo. Mm. And I was kind of like, okay. And, you know, because she's out there promoting this thing, and so I don't know. I don't know where this falls.
I wonder if that was from her dancers.
Yeah.
Dancers, maybe.
Dancers have gone through a whole, like, they've also, like, had a... It's been a minute since I worked in music video, and they used to not be covered. Like, they had their own union as well. Like, my producer's union is trying to put together. But anyway, I wonder if the dancers had something to do with that.
Yeah, it seems like it is a thing that is potentially waived and thus being a even better sting. Because also that helps in multiple reasons. All the SAG-AFTRA members that were in it definitely gets, you know, credit towards it. They get to show it off. And also it's like another thing, kind of like we talked about with, like, even with A24 signing the waiver and getting to continue, just kind of showing that, no, the ball's in your court. You're the only thing holding this up. So
true. Yeah. And this is like not like a big studio put this out. This was kind of her company working directly with AMC Theater. So yeah, they may well indeed have a waiver for all I know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking of movies, on the day we are recording this, October 16th, 2023, it is officially being observed as the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Walt Disney Studios by brothers Walt and Roy Disney in 1923. It's safe to say that Disney has undergone a few changes since those early days when the company was called Disney Brothers Studio. Mickey Mouse made his debut in 1928. Snow White and the Seven Dwarves made waves when it premiered in 1937, Disneyland opened in 1955, and Walt passed away in 1966, well before the company he founded became the entertainment behemoth it is today, which leads us, of course, to the question, is this important? Do you care?
I love American history when it's, 100 years, especially for something film or entertainment related, is an ass long time, but also it's no time. Like, if there's any other kind of country that you're in and you're talking about any history, you're like, 100 years. I have a grandpa that's 100 years older than me. Like, exactly. It's like going to another country and being like, oh yeah, I live in a really old house. It was built in the 1920s or whatever. And they're like, cool. Yeah. I live in a rock that was made in, 1260.
When Nixon went to China, he asked Mao what he thought about the French Revolution, and Mao said, too soon to tell.
Exactly. I do love that, yeah, Disney's such a funny and complicated, like any mass company would. And like at this point, I mostly think of Abigail Disney just railing against her relatives, rightfully so. But it is the cultural impact of Disney is untouched. I mean, you can certainly look at places that they now own, like Fox, like deep film archives of what it means for cinema history and all those. But if you talk about American impact internationally or the American identity, like how Disney is woven into that is absolutely bananas. For people that started doing like just animation, like Steamboat Willie or whatever, and to look at it now and be like, oh yeah, that is a shorthand for capitalism and
Mickey Mouse is McDonald's.
Yeah, it's wild. Absolutely wild. But I don't know. I mean, there's such a soft spot. I'm not a Disney person. Like, some people are like, yeah, rabbit, and they get the pass and they go to the park all the time. And I love that. As you know, I love it when people love things, so go for it. But 100, yeah, it is, if you just look at how that shaped, my parents went to Disney World for their honeymoon. Like, it's just, it's everywhere. If my parents, what hasn't happened? You know what I mean? What haven't they done?
I mean, like, I remember growing up in the sort of home video days where Disney movies would just get reissued every 7 years, like the classic animated films. So like you would wait and it would cycle around. Pinocchio would come out again. Lady and the Tramp would come out again. Song of the South would come out again. I think the last time they reissued that was in the 80s, so it's kind of crazy. Like those movies were so much a presence of my childhood, even though they were already decades old then. But yeah, it definitely, I think, the Mickey Mouse has become this sort of shorthand for kind of like Yankee imperialism, capitalism in a lot of different ways. And, Disney has lived up to that promise by rapaciously sort of like, devouring more and more of the industry as it goes along. So, they put a cute, happy, smiley face on everything, but... Do not mess with the mouse.
You said rapaciously. Come on, I love it. I love words so much. You got such a good word.
Thanks.
Yes. Well, on that note, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, did she do it? We're talking about Anatomy of a Fall.
Hi, I'm Bikram Chatterjee, the CEO of Maximum Fun, and I'm here with my fellow worker owner,
Marissa Flaxbart, producer. This week for Co-Optober, we'll be highlighting other co-ops who work in the arts.
The past few years have been challenging for all kinds of creative industries. We at MaxFun believe that co-ops are better suited to meet these challenges, and there are a lot of other companies who feel the same way.
So all this week on our social media and website, we'll be sharing interviews with some of our fellow co-ops.
And head to our YouTube channel Friday, October 20th, where I'll be talking with worker owners from Defector and Stoxy about their co-ops and why the model works for them.
And next week is Volunteer Week. Learn how you can participate in that and get details on exclusive merch, our live streams, and other Co-Optober happenings at MaximumFun.org/Co-Optober.
That's COOPTOBER.
Back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Evie Wadiwe. In the studio with me are
Drea Clark,
Alonzo Giraldi.
And today's movie comes to us from director Justine Triet. The movie was co-written by Triet and her husband, Arthur Harari. It premiered at this year's Cannes Film Festival, where it won the festival's highest prize, the Palme d'Or. Now it's in limited theatrical release in the U.S., expanding next week. So, Drea, would you mind giving us a brief synopsis of Anatomy of a Fall?
All right, so we begin in a chalet that a family is living in outside of Grenoble, and it is snowy, and they are isolated, and that is only an issue because there's a little tension between the parents. When we meet them, Sandra is being interviewed by a woman about a book that she's recently written, and as her blind son takes a walk and the woman leaves, we're sensing some tension, and then we discover when the son comes back, the husband is now dead, bloody, at the bottom of the house. They don't know what happens. Dun, dun, dun. So the rest of the movie is us moving into a sort of courtroom and thriller and drama relationship intrigue because Sandra is then indicted and charged with his murder because they can't really figure out what happened. And then we get glimpses of her and Samuel, the husband's relationship, to try and figure out what went on, because the only person there who would have had any insight to it is, of course, their blind son. Anatomy of a Fall. Do you get it? The fall is out of the house, but also the fall of their marriage. Do you guys get it? Okay. All right, Anatomy of a Fall.
But not autumn, because it's totally winter in this movie.
Yes.
I love the fact that a married couple wrote this movie, because so much of the film is a dissection of a marriage through the filter of a courtroom drama, through the filter of a mystery and a crime tale. It is about the micro and macro aggressions. It is about the hard truths and the, you know, unfair untruths that get hurled at each other. And so you have this, like, one of the centerpiece moments is this argument that the two of them have had gets played back to the jury, and we get to see it in a flashback.
Yes.
They just hear it, and the difference between those two things and what you take away and who you're, you know, sort of on the side of, like, there's just so much to dig into there.
This movie is fascinating to me. It's compared a lot to Hitchcock in the sense that there is that sort of like, ooh, it's kind of a whodunit, but it's working on all of these other deep personal and psychological levels or whatever. But I'll tell you, I normally do not like it if I don't have a clean reveal, or I like if I'm like, oh, did injustice prevail? Like, there's something like this.
Yeah.
This movie is so beautifully murky in terms of where your sympathy is and where your belief is with what happened. Because, like Alonzo said, we get to see more than certainly the jury does, but not a lot more, and it doesn't clear anything up. Like,
no.
I'm simultaneously, it's that thing where I'm like, oh, I kept switching who I believed, but also I was never against the person I didn't believe, if that makes sense. Like,
yes,
when
absolutely.
I started to question her, when I was like, is she 100% full of shit? Like, is this all self-serving? Is it whatever? But there was still so much complexity built in about, like, how she was a mother, how she was an artist, like, what she was doing in terms of her own personal identity. And the what I was like, yeah, she's got a point, man. Like, lead your own life. Like, their whole argument, I was like, yeah. I'm kind of on her side.
What did they agree to that maybe one of them decided to stop agreeing to? You
know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it was very interesting, and I like that you use, like, murky, because, you know, there are elements, even in that same, like, dissection, I was the same way, where I was like, no, she has every right, it seems like you kind of built yourself into this corner and is lashing out, but then there's, like, the elements when he's like, well, I told him that, you know, I was sleeping with other people, but it's never clarified whether it was agreed upon or she was cheating and then telling him, but, like, she very obviously, because of that, thought that that gave her, you know, more, you know,
carte blanche. Like, impunity.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's ironic because I was the one who last year really pushed for us to talk about Saint-Omer, and that we've now covered two French courtroom dramas.
thanks, fellas.
I guess I do. I didn't know it. But I actually don't like courtroom, like, TV show, mostly because I'm constantly just in the face of, oh, the law is also bullshit. Like, do you know what I mean? Like,
the
injustice there or whatever. And if these movies have taught me anything, it's that I would like to knee a French prosecuting attorney in the balls whenever given the chance, because they're the worst. But this one, it cooks along so much. You're not in the courtroom the whole time. And those complications of story and character, it keeps you moving consistently, and then it also how it integrates their son and his vision impairment, how that came about, how that shaped their dynamic, but also what it does structurally to this, how this movie ends. Like, there is a 20-minute section at the end that I'm like, oh my god, no, this is not like anything that you would read. That writer would get the notes of, we're nowhere near our main character for these pivotal final moments. Like, we're building up to the climax, and our protagonist is not in the scene. What is happening here? And yet it completely works with that idea of what truth is and what, like, because it's just, oh, everything is filtered through moments and what someone is, you know, saying back to you, like, in terms of what courtroom truth is. Or I was amazed, and it is one of those movies I watched it felt much quicker than I thought, but I've thought about it so much since then, because I keep in my head trying to puzzle out, like, I mean, just, this is the briefest of spoilers, it has a resolution, but you don't know how it ends, if that makes it, like,
absolutely,
you do not really know what happened, but it does tie up.
Yeah.
Which to me is a real fine line to walk.
Yeah. Yeah. Like the court case comes to an end, and I feel like in any other movie, we'd either get like a replay of the scene where we see what actually happened, or we get a confession, or we get anything, but really you just see them reacting to what is happening. Now, knowing that this won a Palme d'Or and was a French film, I knew we weren't going to get the answer. I know, that's their thing. They fucking love it. Do the French love to be like, you decide, I'm going to go smoke a cigarette. You
know, like,
that is that is how they make movies. But I loved it. I loved, because then it makes, knowing that, it makes you try and see if there's any slip up, any clues. And then you are also in the jury chair for these courtroom scenes. And yeah, it was real lovely, real exciting. But yeah, at the end, you're just like, this could be someone who was guilty's reaction or someone who was innocent's reaction. But I am glad, spoiler alert, that she kissed that hot lawyer, because I'm like, if she doesn't kiss that hot lawyer, I'm going to lose it.
She sort of. And also doesn't kiss the hot lawyer. There's so much sexual tension between
the two.
Right? Like, there's this whole moment. I don't remember her kissing. Like, she does this sort of, like, it's this French. She holds his face. This is a movie, too. And I also think when people talk about, like, this having any sort of Hitchcock virtues, it's, there's so much thoughtfulness that goes into every single framing, but none of it is that kind of theatrical performative Hitchcock, which is like, rah, look at it's, oh, here's our big framing from Vertigo or whatever, like, oh, it's an askew thing, Rear Window, like, this is the like every conversation you're given a different power dynamic, like when she is speaking to the lawyer and it's sort of all in his hands and she really wants him to believe you, like, there's just the small difference of where the camera is looking, like, of, oh, she looks small and nervous at this point. And then I'll say, this is sort of a spoiler, it's sort of not, but I could talk for 1,000 hours about how the very end of this, she comes home, she's reunited with the son. This whole thing has happened that involved, this is their first time to each other since this whole thing has happened. Well, part of this thing. And she scoops him up and he's not a small boy. He's like an 11-year-old. She scoops him up like a toddler and carries him up the stairs to bed, holding him in this very like, oh, this infantile, like protective, like, oh, I'm a mother. I'm holding him like he's like a baby again. And you're like, okay, got it. Wrapped my head around, got it. Dynamic set. And then puts him in, and then they have a moment where she leans in to hug him, and then he's like holding her. Is it a pietà, that like Italian pose?
Yes.
And he's like holding her like he's this benevolent angel. I just was like, Jesus, like just those, this unspoken thing of what you are taking away in those moments. And they are none of them heavy-handed. It's just like, or it's just a mom carrying her son to bed. And them hugging. Like, it's boop, so small, but so much.
I think the other Hitchcockian thing is that, like, this is a character that whatever the verdict winds up being, you believe that it's possible.
Like, yes.
Like, okay, no, I guess she didn't do it. Oh, she did. Okay, yeah, I could see that, too. Like, it works either way. And Sandra Hüller is giving such a... And by the way, she's having a season, because she's also in Jonathan Glazer's The Zone of Interest, and is terrifying in that movie in a totally different way.
Yeah, phenomenal.
But yeah, she's so great in both of these. But yeah, here, like, the character, there's never anything sort of like... obviously malignant about her, but there is just enough narcissism or just enough whatever entitlement. Yeah. It's like, okay, maybe she did it. I don't know.
And yet you could explain all those away with either A, she's an artist, B, she's German. Like,
yes.
Who, you know?
Also, maybe to be clear, the prosecuting attorney you want to knee in the balls in this movie, I believe, is Swiss.
Oh, okay. You know what? My borders are open for what prosecutors I'd like to knee in the balls. How's that?
You got the whole EU is
wide representational swath, exactly. her prickliness, it's also like that when they go to the scene, and it's even the how they parse out how you see the husband, Samuel, for so long. You are introduced to him because you will hear a kettle drum version of 50 Cent's PIMP like 8 times in a row.
Oh.
It will be stuck in your head for at least a good week, if not more. And you do not see him for so long. And then I was like, oh, are we never going to see it? Is this going to be entirely just like us? And then when they do reveal it, that's what I'm saying. How this movie perfectly balances the sympathies of what you're doing and what you're thinking at any point and the valid natures of both their complaints.
And really, like, you know, like with any sort of married couple, it comes down to like, is he telling the truth? Is she telling the truth? Are they both? Are neither? Like, you know, it could there's so many kind of things there where you could sort of parse it out. But like, well, maybe they each have their own perspective on this, but they're both looking at it through this skewed filter, and the objective truth is something else. And then, is there an objective truth? And you know, yeah, this movie wraps its arms around a lot, but it's gripping. It is not this sort of flaccid kind of, you know, philosophical exercise.
No,
it is a thrilling like courtroom story.
Can I, and you, I'm glad you brought out Sandra Hüller, whom I think is incredible. She was in a staff pick I had forever ago called Tony Erdman. And she's just such a talent. The son in this, scene where the son is just watching something on screen. And I was like, where the F did they find this kid? Like, I feel like he's actually blind. I'm like, how did you find a young blind actor? Are you kidding me? Like, he, there's, you know what I'm talking about, Iffy? Did you have that reaction as well?
Oh, yeah. This kid was so good. And then my nerdy eyes, I'm very curious because I think I saw a little bit of a contact when it got there, because I was in because I was in that AMC laser. So, you know, I was able to get the huge details.
Sure.
But this kid,
Milo Machado Grainer is his name.
Oh, my God.
Milo Machado Grainer is just crushing every scene, every emotion. You know, I was like, damn, this prequel for No Country for Old Men is going hard. You know, like, it is, that's, I'm
just
sorry.
The
I
had hair. To,
I,
just
yeah,
the
I,
hair.
I could not, see that once my brain was like, you know what that looked like? Yeah. But his emotion.
He has Anton Chigurh's hair.
Yeah. There's so many scenes where he's not saying anything, but I am able to read every emotion that he is giving. So 10
out
of 10.
But you also believe that he's a kid. Like, you believe that it is all through the filter of this kid who's trying to puzzle his way through something that is beyond his conception. I'll say, too, for any animal lovers that listen, he's got the cutest dog in the world. And there is a, the dog makes it. I'll spoil it. The dog is fine. I would have loved to have known that going into it, because I was like, oh my God, what's going on? But there is like a dog scene that I'm like, did they drug an actual, is this a fake dog? What's, is this a CG? Is this an AI dog? What's happening here? It's very upsetting.
No, and this movie, in addition to winning the Palme d'Or, won the Palme Dog at Cannes for Best Canine Performance.
Rightfully so.
Deservedly.
No, I was so thrown by this. I'll say, too, that whether or not the actor actually was visually impaired, having that character be, like, that's something that in a lot of stories seems like, oh, okay, that's a very short story. Like, it seems kind of neat. Like, oh, really?
Because he's the witness, but...
Yeah, you know. Right? Like, oh, like, however, how it's utilized and what it means for, like, they have this really extended scene of him. Is he able to hear something? And this, and just this way of how he makes through the world. Like, it's thought out and integrated. You're like, oh, this character is actually, like, it's a fully believable thing. And how it influences the story at every stage. Because it changes, like, he's given a sort of court-appointed advocate. And it changes that dynamic. Like, that, you know, when he literally has to hold someone's arm to make it through the courtroom, it just, what that means to how you're perceiving this kid and how the mother perceives him, like, fascinating choices.
And I'd never thought about the logistics of a kid who is a witness in a trial regarding his own mother.
Yeah.
And how, like, the court has to sort of separate them for, you know, legal reasons, basically. It's like, oh, yeah, I guess that totally makes sense.
So murky. And my last thing is, again, tying to St. Omer, give it up for the French court system, where everybody gets to speak in long paragraphs as long as they want, and they can talk back and forth with the judge, with the other attorney, with another witness. Oh, my God, the last thing that we didn't... Okay, but one of the main things in this, because she's German, her husband's French, they live in France, they speak English in the home, that there's a whole thing that they speak French in the home, is what I was trying to say, the language.
Yeah.
But that idea, St. Omer had elements of that too, of like what the difference of language means for the power in any situation. But also, because she's a writer and words are her tools, and you see her very carefully use them along the way, and they've asked her to speak French in the courtroom, and there's times when she switches to English. I just also, I could just analyze that. I could analyze that for days and be like, Is she lying? I feel like she fully could say all this. She's doing a whole thing. Like, it's fascinating.
Yeah, it's good.
And it ties into the whole thing about, again, that argument with the husband where it's like, what are they saying? What do they mean when they say that? Are they telling the truth when they say that? Are they saying things to each other in a personal way that an outside observer would never, you know, understand or figure out? Antoine Reinartz plays the attorney who should hide his balls around Drea, because he's a piece of work.
That mother. I'll find you. Okay, I'll I won't. Don't. I, let's take that out, maybe.
You heard it here first. Super festival program producer.
I'm threatening fictional characters. Great. Yeah. Great.
Oh, man. Yeah, no, it was such a solid performance, because yeah, I definitely hated that man. I was ready to jump through.
I appreciate you watching this, Iffy. I love when we get to make you watch things like this and then you enjoy them more than anybody else.
Yeah, you know, this might be my new Judy. Who will know? Only time will tell.
Should we vote? Are we gonna vote on this?
Let's go and vote. Yeah. The way the votes work here on the channel, if you've never, the podcast, the entire network, if Flophouse isn't doing this, give them a strongly worded email. No, the way that we vote here on this podcast is screen it being the highest, stream it being the next level, and skip it being self-explanatory. So who wants to start?
Oh, I mean, screen it, no question. Not only for how extraordinarily put together it is, how great the script is, how great the performances are, but I mean, this is, first of all, you really want to take in Simon Beaufoy's photography, of the way that he makes the Alps both sort of breathtaking and foreboding at the same time. And it's just, there's so much subtle detail that you want to be paying attention to. This is a movie that you would ideally not be watching at home, not be watching with like your phone or your laptop within reach, like just in a dark room, taking it all in. And I have to say, kudos to Neon, because this is the third year in a row that they managed to snag the Palme d'Or winner at Cannes on the heels of Titan and Triangle of Sadness. So, you know, whoever is in acquisitions over there, well done. You really can tell where that jury's going every year, it seems.
This is also a screen it for me. It is one of those ones that I'm like, ooh, I would recommend this. But it is fully the kind of film that I'm like, I always like to temper expectations. I feel like when people get too hyped about a film is when they're like, oh, well, Dreyfus, this is going to change my life. And then they're like,
too talky.
Right? But this movie, it cooks along. It's doing so much. I find it's just a very easy, rapid watch for 2.5 hours. But yeah, it's also like doing a lot of intricate things that are so, so riveting. So, yeah. And Sandra Huller, like, I hope this is the, I would love to see her get an Oscar nod for this.
That's everything they said and more. I am also a screen it. So definitely go check that out. But we'll be right back after we hear from another show, Maximum Fun.
All right, class. Tomorrow's exam will cover the science of cosmic rays, the morals of art forgery, and whether or not fish can drown. Any questions? Yes, you in the back. What is this?
It's the podcast Let's Learn Everything,
where we learn about science and a bit of everything else. My name's Tom. I study cognitive and computer science, but I'll also be your teacher for intermediate emojis.
My name's Caroline, and I did my master's in biodiversity conservation, and I'll be teaching you intro to things the British Museum stole.
My name's Ella. I did a PhD in stem cell biology, so obviously I'll be teaching you the history of fan fiction.
Class meets every other Thursday on Maximum Fun.
So do I still get credit for this?
No.
Obviously not.
No.
It's a podcast.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Iffy Wadiway. In the studio with me are
Alonzo Duraldi,
Drea Clark.
And today we've got another category for the Hall of Excellence, inspired by this movie's many, many testimonies. We're nominating the Best Movie Testimony Under Oath. Maybe it's a scene in a courtroom drama, or maybe it's a courtroom scene in a goofy comedy. As long as someone has sworn to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, it's fair game. Who's got one?
I do, because I already know the one we all want, and I'm claiming it.
Okay.
And if you think I'm not going to do a "you can't handle the truth" from A Few Good Men, then you don't know how happy I am to pander to the crowd. It's Jack Nicholson as what? Colonel Jessup? Like, yes. The whole thing, yeah. It's building up.
Colonel Jessup, did you order the code red?
You don't have to answer that question.
I'll answer the question. You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
You can't handle the truth!
That movie, linchpin of American cinema right there. Find somebody who does not know that and has not made that in like a terrible pun when someone at some point asks them for the truth. You can't handle the truth. Are you kidding me? You guys, yeah. Hall of Excellence. Like, that's what testimony looks like. I had one other one in mind, and I'm kind of so curious to see if it's the one Alonzo has.
Well, okay, Alonzo, I was not going to give a basic bitch answer like that. So, you know.
I told you, I'm pandering. I got no problem with pandering.
Fair enough. Mine is the surprise witness in Billy Wilder's Witness for the Prosecution, based on the play by Agatha Christie. I can't get into detail about it because it would be a major spoiler, but I will just say... a woman comes in and gives testimony that turns the entire trial around, and it's a big actory moment. on the witness stand is Marlena Dietrich. I can say that much.
Damn you! Damn you!
Leave her alone!
Daniel!
Mrs. Hill!
Let me go! Let me get out of here! Let me go!
And Mrs. Hill!
Let me go!
Asha, give the witness a chair.
Marlena Dietrich getting cross-examined in Witness for the Prosecution. She burns the house down. And it is a great, memorable, hammy moment. If you've seen the movie, you know what I'm talking about. And it absolutely underscores like everything that a courtroom drama can and should be in terms of just like sheer theatrics. So that's my favorite.
I want you to know, Alonzo, my heart is full because that is exactly the performance I thought and hoped you would say.
Good.
Literally, exactly. I'm going to sleep like an angel.
Iffy, what do you got?
He's so mad at me for taking that.
I mean, definitely that probably would have been my see, what makes it hard is that it has to be the testimony.
Exactly.
If it was courtroom scenes, then you know, Legally Blonde would have been in here.
Girl, that's what anyone knows if you've had a perm that you can't perm maintenance is you cannot wash your hair for 24 hours. Yep.
I can recommend one that I bet you do love.
Okay, go for it.
It involves one of your favorite performers.
Okay.
That would be Academy Award winner Marissa Tomei in My Cousin Vinny.
Let's go ahead and say that. Yeah.
What is positraction?
It's a limited slip differential which distributes power equally to both the right and left tires. The 64 Skylark had a regular differential, which anyone who's been stuck in the mud in Alabama knows. You step on the gas, one tire spins, the other tire does nothing.
That's right.
Is that it?
No, there's more.
Yeah, but you can pick the pandery, you can pick the deep cut, or you can pick the Tomei. Just let us know. Let us know. We've given you three great options.
There are no bad answers except pick one.
Exactly.
Those are really good. I feel very good about all three of those.
Oh yeah, exactly. Yeah. I don't know what anyone is going to pick, because now we turn it over to you. Go to our Facebook page at facebook.com/groups/maximumfilm. And if you don't have a Facebook, but you really want to vote, you can always send an email to maximumfilm@maximumfun.org. All right. The power's in your hand now. The ball's in your court. And we are adjourned. And now it's time for Saf Picks. It could be any movie at all. Who wants to start?
Can I start only because now I have the sneaking suspicion this was Alonzo's last week?
Okay, Alonzo,
Alonzo, did you do Fair Play last week?
I did not.
Oh, then I have one. So yeah, my staff pick for this week is a film currently on Netflix that was one of the sort of Sundance buzzy films this year called Fair Play. It is a drama erotic thriller starring Phoebe Dynevor from Bridgerton and Alden Ehrenreich from Everything, and yet you don't ever know who he is. And it has a whole like 80s feel to it. It's a couple who's been dating secretly who work in a hedge fund, and then one of them gets a promotion and they're like kind of at odds with each other, and it's this intense finance bro world, but it's 2023. And yeah, I enjoy it. There's a sexiness to it. There's a thriller to it. It's a first time female filmmaker named Chloe Domont. Very excited to see what she does next. Yeah, Netflix. It's available to watch for your viewing pleasure. Check it out.
If Adrian Lyne had made Wall Street.
Girl, that's the pitch. Yes.
My pick this week also screened at the Cannes Film Festival this year alongside Anatomy of a Fall, but it was not up for the Palme d'Or because it is not a feature film. It is Pedro Almodovar's short, Strange Way of Life, which is now showing in theaters everywhere. Even here in Greenville, South Carolina, where I currently am, you can go see this movie. It is a 25-minute ish Western with Ethan Hawke and Pedro Pascal as long separated lovers who reunite under difficult circumstances later in their lives. It is bold and sexy and an homage to Sergio Leone, who shot most of his spaghetti Westerns in Spain. And if there's anything that I don't like about it, it's that I want the feature film. This is an amuse-bouche that's like, I want an entire plate of this, please, more. But I'll take what I got, and it's all great. And it is currently showing in American theaters, coupled with Pedro Almodovar's last short film, his adaptation of Jean Cocteau's The Human Voice, starring Tilda Swinton. So these are both mostly in English. And they're incredible films, and I really recommend that you see them. And it's very exciting to get to see short films in a movie theater because there's not a lot of commercial opportunities to do that. So go check them out.
Yes. Nice. And this one is just a little friend boost, but I want to shout out Totally Killer, and with my monthly horror theme, directed by Nanochka Khan, and it's just a horror movie where 17-year-old Jamie comes face to face with a mass maniac and is time traveling back to 1987. So she's fighting against slasher tropes while she's fighting against a slasher, and it's like a fun horror comedy. Give that a watch. It's on Amazon Prime Video now.
It's very fun. And if you are someone who doesn't like scares, it's not scary at all. There's blood, but it's not scary at all. But also, Kiernan Shipka's character throughout wears a jacket very similar to the one from Can't Buy Me Love. And if you are the kind of person that will appreciate that, then you will enjoy Totally Killer.
All right. Well, Dre and Alonzo, thank you for another wonderful show. Shout out to you. And you, listener, thank you for listening. If you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, send us an email at maximumfilm@maximumfun.org or find us on any of our other social media channels. And all those links are in the show notes. Remember to vote for the Hall of Excellence on Facebook. And next week, we're talking about Killers of the Flower Moon. Our producer is Marissa Flaxpart. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of Maximum Fun. Bye-bye.
Yay!
Maximum Fun, a worker-owned network
of artist-owned shows.
Supported
directly
by you.